You're listening to Thought Huddle. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This is a podcast produced by Arizona State University, and it's for audiences everywhere, not just those under the desert sun. We engage with fascinating people on a wide variety of subjects, people who are thinkers and doers and motivated by the desire to create meaningful impact. Thought Huddle explores ideas, tells stories, and hopefully makes some sense of our complicated and beautiful world. We're talking today about Alzheimer's disease. This is a terrible disease that can affect anyone, no matter how healthy or active they are. And it seems that almost everyone has a story about someone they know, someone in their family. My own stepfather got early onset Alzheimer's disease and died of it. I remember when my mother told me that she knew something was really wrong. She and George were sitting in the living room and he repeatedly asked her about their friend Peter. But they didn't have a friend named Peter. George was an ambitious man. He'd served in the military, and after that, he became a college professor, and then a university president, and finally the head of a major museum. He loved to read, play sports, go ocean fishing on his motorboat, and all of those things were destroyed by Alzheimer's. His decline was a rocky ride for the family. He started doing crazy things like walking unbidden into the house of neighbors, even of complete strangers. He became the target of phone scammers who specifically target elderly people and people with dementia. And he spent thousands of dollars on things like bogus lottery tickets until my mother finally canceled all his credit cards. He insisted on driving his car long after he should have, a problem that my mother solved actually kind of creatively by talking to the police chief in the small town where they'd retired. He showed up in full uniform and told George that he was officially no longer permitted to drive, and that did the trick, as George's mind, weak as it was, still respected authority. There were unexpected moments of grace, too. I went back east one Christmas when my mother was still taking care of George at the house. The truth is that he'd never really liked me very much. He was from a generation and a subculture that had been raised with certain prejudices, and one of them was that he did not see women as equals. But as his memory faded, he forgot that, and he became friendly, almost childlike. When my mother was in the other room, he told me, he said, "I'm so glad that you've come home for Christmas, not just for your mother's sake, but for my sake, and you are a wonderful person." That was the first time in my life that he'd ever said anything like that. It was extremely moving, and at the time I chose to believe that he was expressing his real open-hearted self that had long been hidden behind cultural prejudices. But looking back, I'm not so sure that this is true. Other people with Alzheimer's disease can turn aggressive, paranoid, even dangerous to themselves and others. There's no way to predict the manifestations or rate of progression of the disease. And even moments of lucidity and awareness are completely unpredictable gifts. I know that Christmas I was given a rare and beautiful gift. George was in his mid-60s when he was diagnosed. It was nearly 100 years after the physician Alois Alzheimer described a patient with profound losses of language and memory and ever-worsening psychological problems. That patient, upon her death, was found to have deposits in and around the nerve cells of her brain, the amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles that are now known as hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. When the Alzheimer's Association was founded in 1980, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, reported about 1,000 cases. Today, close to 50 million people worldwide have Alzheimer's and other dementia-related illnesses. In the U.S. alone, there are 5.7 million Americans afflicted with Alzheimer's. And with many baby boomers now well over 65, that population could grow upwards of 14 million by mid-century. To say that Alzheimer's has become a public health crisis is an understatement. It's a full-on epidemic. There's no cure in sight, and there are 500,000 new cases and over 100,000 deaths each year in the U.S. We're going to be talking about how the disease is affecting our lives and our economy, about the state of research for prevention and treatment of the illness, and how people's quality of life can actually be maintained and even improved while they have the disease, even when they seem to be pretty far gone. Morgan Hartford is the Southern Arizona Regional Director at the Alzheimer's Association, and he laid out the brutal facts.
Alzheimer's is a terminal illness. Unfortunately, the progressive nature of Alzheimer's disease means that as it progresses, it will cause different parts of the brain to shut down, including the brain stem. So parts of the brain that are responsible for breathing, chewing, swallowing, that do lead to death should a person not succumb to some other condition before that.
Do they tend to die of Alzheimer's first, or is it other things?
It's often other things, which is why for so long Alzheimer's has not been listed as cause of death on death certificates. So the numbers of deaths attributed to Alzheimer's is actually historically underreported, even though a person may pass away from something like pneumonia or an infection. Often Alzheimer's was the culprit. So if a person's, for example, not able to swallow as well or eat, that may make them more susceptible for infections like pneumonia.
What researchers do know about Alzheimer's is that it differs from other kinds of dementia.
So it really comes down to what's happening inside the brain cell. With Alzheimer's disease specifically, we see these hallmark plaques and tangles that are real specific proteins that attack the brain in a very specific way. Now, that's different depending on other types of dementia. Other forms of dementia, like dementia with Lewy bodies, for example, different protein is at play, and it occurs in a different part of the brain cell. So dementia is just this overarching umbrella term that we use as sort of a catch-all, but it doesn't really describe what's happening at the cellular level. So as we learn more about these different forms of dementia, we're able to get much more specific, and people can achieve then what's called a differential diagnosis to understand the difference between Alzheimer's or some other form that might be at play.
Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, says Hartford, with 60 to 80% of all cases of dementia being Alzheimer's. At the Alzheimer's Association, there's a lot of work on making this differentiation, as an accurate diagnosis is possible while people are still living, and that diagnosis can lead to interventions that can improve the quality of life.
With the tools that we have, this differential diagnosis can be made with about 90% accuracy while the person's alive, which really flies in the face of, you know, what's been, it's still out there in the public, that the sense of, well, the only way to make it an accurate diagnosis is upon autopsy. And that line of thinking often keeps people from getting a diagnosis or pursuing a diagnosis because there's a sense of, well, what does it matter? And I couldn't really find out anyway.
Once an official diagnosis is made, the question of long-term care becomes essential. And many of those decisions can depend on a family's resources, both economic resources and people who can take the role of caregivers. And it's not easy. In our own family, my mother took care of George as long as she could. But after several years, she had to put him in an institution. Luckily, he had the means to afford a good care center. Even then, by the time he died, he'd blown through most of his life savings. Morgan Hartford says that only 30% of Alzheimer's patients enter long-term care facilities. Part of the reason for this is that the cost of private facilities can run anywhere from $3,000 to $14,000 a month. The other 70% of patients are cared for at home, which still presents immense burdens both emotionally and financially. And if someone has no family, no assets, and no support system, they can end up in adult protective services and in state-run facilities that may be under par. And no matter how good or bad the care, the financial cost to society is enormous. In 2018 alone, the total financial toll of the disease was $277 billion.
And by 2050, these costs could go as high as $1.1 trillion. So we see this exponential rise in the costs associated with Alzheimer's disease. And if we look at how it impacts the different systems, buckets of money that we're talking about here, Medicaid costs will reach $364 million for people with Alzheimer's this year. And then Medicare spending on people with dementia in 2017, for example, was $23,885 per person.
And those numbers don't include the countless unpaid work hours of family members. In 2018, Hartford said 16 million Americans were caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's, accounting for 8.4 billion hours of unpaid care. That's $232 billion of unpaid care that's being provided by families this year. Hartford does have some important advice for families.
So long-term care insurance, I can't say enough about the importance of long-term care insurance working in this field and seeing how helpful it can be for people that utilize those policies early. But the reality is that that's a really small percentage of the population that can really draw on their long-term care insurance to help offset the costs of care. But really what we're seeing is that most of those costs are out of pocket. And for the state to be able to pick up some of those costs, there really is an income threshold that families have to make. And that doesn't always afford the highest quality of care or the most amenities that families would want.
He also advises setting up a support system early with friends and family to prepare for the progression of the disease, however it manifests. People should make sure early on that their wishes for care are clear and documented. While the dollar numbers tell a story, the emotional impact, waves of what Hartford calls ambiguous loss, can also devastate families and patients hoping for better care.
The person ends up losing often the things that are important to them, most often because they haven't planned early and they haven't talked about this with anyone and been able to maintain a network or reach out for help, which is why we strongly encourage people to recognize these changes early. Reach out for assistance, whether that's through the Alzheimer's Association or their area agency on aging, friends. We need to start talking about this issue in this country so that we can really prevent some of the worst situations, including people living alone with Alzheimer's.
As the number of Alzheimer's cases grows, there is great hope that funding and therapies, both traditional and alternative, will grow as well. Already, Hartford says, funding for research has increased to $2.3 billion annually. This funding will go toward research on prevention and treatment, but there are other aspects that Hartford also feels should change.
I think in regard to patient care, I think the importance of disclosure of diagnosis is really important. We know that less than half of people with Alzheimer's disease report ever being told by their doctor that they have the disease. So disclosure of diagnosis is really important. Being able to help people understand what it means to have Alzheimer's disease and then point them to the resources that can be supportive to them. That would go a long way in providing the kind of care and support that people need post-diagnosis. Certainly, we want the public to know that while Alzheimer's disease is not a normal part of aging, it's something that we should all be aware of, and that there is quality of life in dementia.
Another recommendation is simply to look out for one another. If you have a friend or family member showing signs of significant memory loss, have the conversation and be the supportive person in his or her life. That person may not have anyone else. So now to the good news, or better news anyway. With the growing number of Alzheimer's cases, there's also a lot more research and some real progress in understanding the disease. Diego Mastroeni is a neuroscientist and researcher at the Arizona State University Banner Neurodegenerative Research Center at the Biodesign Institute at ASU, and he has his own personal story of how he began to study Alzheimer's disease.
The field kind of chose me instead of me choosing the field. I was a young man. I was about 16 years old, and my grandfather had dementia, and he had frontotemporal dementia, more kind of aggressive type of dementia. And it was kind of a tough road for me. I grew up with my grandfather. He was a good friend of mine, not only a grandfather, but someone that I worked with all the time as well. I remember trying to teach him how to speak English. He's from Italy, so he still, even when he was in the United States, he only spoke Italian. I was about 16. My folks asked me if I would put my grandfather in a retirement home in a dementia facility because he became really aggressive and he wouldn't trust my parents to take him anywhere. So I unfortunately had to take him in. And it was definitely the most difficult thing I've ever done, even to this day. I had to lie to him and take him in this facility and see him get dragged into this place. I knew it was best for the family, but it was not easy for a 16-year-old boy. So from then on, I initially thought I was going to medical school to treat the condition, but I did a rotation in a lab, and I realized that I think I can have more of an influence on the disease doing research, so less of a kind of Band-Aid treatment and more of why is this going on.
We talked about the progression of the disease, which begins earlier than you might think.
It's really important to mention that Alzheimer's disease really starts in our 20s and 30s. And this is one of the reasons why it's so difficult for us as researchers to figure out how do we treat a disease that started 40, 50 years ago. There's so much damage, so much pathology that there's not a whole lot that we can do. So this is kind of the reason that a lot of the research that we do, at least at ASU, is focused on preventative medicine.
So what exactly causes Alzheimer's? That's the big question. According to Mastroianni, there are many theories and still so much that we don't know.
There's a lot of different theories. One of them is neuroinflammation. There's also the loss of nerve cells is just a function of aging. We're all living well beyond our biological ages. If you could imagine that most individuals shouldn't even live until 80 or 90 years old. And in doing so, you will naturally lose more nerve cells. It's not known exactly why this is happening. I mean, this is the biggest problem. This is why there's so much research in Alzheimer's disease, because there's so many of unknowns still to this day. We're still focusing on the same clinical features and pathological features that were described more than 100 years ago. So the field does need to move forward, whether it's neuroinflammation or synaptic loss or the association between neurofibrillary tangles and synaptic loss. There's a lot of options. It's really vague.
What is less vague is that the greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's is age. According to the Alzheimer's Association, 1 in 9 people will have developed Alzheimer's by the time they're 65, and 1 in 3 by the time they're 85. There's also a genetic component. People who test positive for the APOE gene are said to have a much higher chance of getting Alzheimer's, up to 80 to 90% if you have the gene coming from both parents, which may account for the fact that even people who do everything right to prevent the disease still end up getting it. Yet even with the presence of the gene, environmental factors still play a big part in determining whether someone will get Alzheimer's.
There's a pair of identical twins, and they're both equally educated. They're both PhDs, chemical engineers, and one of the twins got Alzheimer's disease and the other twin didn't. And that was really strange to us. But what we found is that the one twin that got Alzheimer's disease worked in a DDT plant, which is a pesticide. And the other twin that did not get Alzheimer's disease did not work in a pesticide plant. He just worked in an office job. So it's not just your genes. It's also the environment that you live in.
Another risk factor is gender. Women are 6 times more likely to develop the disease, says Mastroianni, and women who have undergone hysterectomies also have a significantly higher incidence. But the deep research on that is really just beginning.
Some work that was just done by Heather Busmonte Nelson here at ASU had some very interesting findings. The uterus for years was always thought to be some kind of just a housing unit for a child, and it had no biological relevance. But the work that she's done recently has shown that it does have biological relevance. So removing things like when you're getting a hysterectomy will increase your risk for developing diseases because it regulates a lot of things that we just weren't aware of, like hormones and estrogen levels, for example. In addition to that, women are at increased risk besides hysterectomies. They've shown that women are sometimes even, 6 times more likely to get Alzheimer's disease than men. It's all going to come back down to hormones, I think, to change quite dramatically, right, through menopause. I mean, we have this huge fluctuation, which men just don't have. We have a gradual decrease in testosterone over a period of time, but women go through major fluctuations in hormones.
The work that Mastroianni and his team are doing at ASU looks at a specific part of the cell, the mitochondria, which, as we remember from high school biology, is the powerhouse of the cell. It turns out that protecting them is really important in protecting against Alzheimer's disease.
As we get older, just aging, we see this dramatic decrease in mitochondrial function. And so our hypothesis was to test whether or not if protecting the mitochondria early in life would have positive effects on reducing one's risk, not only for Alzheimer's disease, but just healthy aging. Some of this work that we've done in collaboration with Sid Hecht and Omar Kardur, the bioorganic chemists who developed these coenzyme Q10 analogs, they're multi-radical quenchers. So they do a lot of multiple protection on the mitochondria. And in doing so, we found that it's been quite protective and protecting against things like amyloid beta, the thing that's being built up in the Alzheimer's brain.
So before you run out and buy coenzyme Q10 analogs, Mastroeni warns, you should know that most of the supplements that you can buy at this point over the counter break down really quickly, and they get used by the liver or other organs before they ever reach the brain. So they might be very helpful for other things, but they're not going to protect against Alzheimer's. Part of the focus now is developing not only these protective molecules, but also a delivery system for them that will cross the blood-brain barrier and actually target brain cells. There are several options in the development phase, including a nasal spray that would actually allow the protective molecules to reach the brain intact.
I think it will be really important to target the nerve cells. The reason I think it's so important is that, and people may not realize this, but the nerve cell that you have when you're born are the same nerve cells you have when you die. So you could have a nerve cell that you have lived with for 100 years could be in your brain. So you could imagine if this cell was exposed to a lot of free radical damage, a lot of things that oxidative stress and all these things, they would be very bad for the mitochondria. So protecting the mitochondria would be quite advantageous in an aging cell.
Another crucial way of preventing Alzheimer's disease is maintaining brain neuroplasticity, or what Mastroeni calls synaptic connectivity. The connections between brain cells, called synapses, are what form our memories.
The reality is you have a certain amount of synapses. And as we lose these synapses or these connections between nerve cells, then what happens is that the body is asking, or the brain is asking, you know, I can't make this connection any longer. So you keep on losing more and more of these connections. You keep on losing synaptic plasticity. So now it's much more difficult to recall memories, things like this.
So how do we keep our synapses going? One way is simply learning the way we did when we were young.
I think what happens is that as we age, we become complacent, right? So when we're a child, we're constantly learning. We're learning new things. We're learning how to write, learning how to read, learning how to ride a bike, draw, color, paste, whatever. All these things are making new connections. And as we get older, we stop making these connections. It's not about doing something over and over and over again. It's about doing something different over and over again. So learn to draw, learn to paint, do something that you've never done before. These are the kinds of things that will create more synapses. I can tell you personally, my own experiences, every year I demand that I learn something new. So one year it was art. So I was painting a whole year. And you get pretty good after a year of painting. And I did drawing, and I could never draw. I did that for a year, and I became a pretty proficient drawer. And then I took on woodworking last year. I'm always trying something new. Next year is going to be a new language. So yeah, I think that if you could do that, and if everybody did that, I think that would reduce your risk of a lot of these conditions, but also enrich your life.
Diet and nutrition also play a part. The Mediterranean diet, for example, which is rich in fruits and vegetables, legumes, whole grains, nuts, and seafood, and olive oil, can be really healthy. Basically, anything we've been told is good for our hearts, now we know is good for our brains as well.
Exercise, diet, nutrition, all these things are very, very, very important. Even in the aging brain, we find a lot of the arteries, the veins and the vessels, etc., are also filled with plaques, very similar to the heart. So protecting your heart also protects your brain. Without your heart, your brain is worthless. So you need to do both. You need to do diet, nutrition, exercise. You have to learn new things. In my personal opinion, you have to try to protect your mitochondria. Stress is a major cofactor for not just Alzheimer's disease, but everything. Every bad thing that could happen to our bodies, stress is a major, major factor. It releases a lot of really neurotoxic elements, a lot of cortisol, a lot of things that you just don't want flowing around in your body and your peripheral system. You don't want it crossing into your blood-brain barrier. So things that are relaxing like yoga are very, very important. I think it's incredibly important to stay fit in terms of both mind and body.
We've been talking about preventing Alzheimer's disease and the difficulty of treating it because once symptoms are there, the disease is pretty far advanced. But is there any kind of cure in sight?
This is a reality that I think all scientists can generally agree on, is that once you've been clinically diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, it is essentially a sentence. Now, whether the effects of the disease can be slowed down, now that's possible. There's a lot of work being done on that right now. But in my personal opinion, I think that it's going to be prevention. We don't really talk about curing Alzheimer's disease. We talk about preventing it. So if we can slow down the disease, let's say even by 10 years, people will be, well, 90, 100 years old before you get dementia. That would be fantastic. I mean, it would be awful to get dementia, but if you get it when you're 100 years old, well, okay. It's just the people that are 60 and 70 and still have a ton of really good quality years of life that we're really worried about right now.
There's a small number of FDA-approved medications for slowing down memory loss. They act on the brain's neurotransmitters. Unfortunately, they don't work for everyone, they don't actually change the progression of the disease, and they can have serious side effects. Still, they're the best choice for some patients. There are some alternatives, though, that improve the quality of life, and they may actually have a real effect on the brain itself. Gary Glasner is a poet, and he's founder and executive director of the Alzheimer's Poetry Project. He started to work with Alzheimer's patients by chance in the late 1990s in Berkeley, California, when he got a poetry grant that sent him to an adult day program for people with memory loss.
The moment of inspiration, the story that I love to share with people, is there was a guy in the group, and his head was down, and I thought he was probably asleep and not aware of what was going on at all, and I said the Longfellow poem. I shot an arrow into the air, and his eyes popped open, and he said, "It fell to earth, I knew not where." And he got this big smile on his face, and you know, it was clearly very satisfying for him to say it. And suddenly he was back with us and was able to participate. And it just was a beautiful moment, very inspiring moment as a person and certainly as a poet to see how useful the poems could be.
Now, 20 years later, Glasner has started Alzheimer's poetry programs across the country as well as internationally, and recently co-authored an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association on the effects of poetry and song on Alzheimer's patients. He uses the age-old technique of call and response.
When you're using call and response, you're using a particular kind of memory called echo or echoic memory, and this was a term that was coined by Ulrich Nesser in 1967, and he's considered by many people to be the father of cognitive psychology. And so he was doing a lot of study around sense memories, and that this is an auditory sense memory. And the way I like to explain it is it's the kind of memory that if I was to say my phone number is 505-577 da 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 da, and you hold that in your mind long enough to write it down or to dial it, that auditory loop that's keeping it alive in your mind is echoic memory. And so that's what we're tapping into when we're using call and response. And it seems anecdotally that even in fairly late stage dementia that people can be successful at saying back the words. So yeah, call and response is just a powerful, powerful tool. It's in almost all music, but especially blues, right? There's a blues scholar, Adam Gusso, who thinks that we use call and response in blues to say you're not alone. So when the singer sings, you know, "Baby, please don't go," and then the response shows that the singer's not alone. So I think there's so many different ways call and response is in our communities.
Well, call and response does seem to be a fundamental human activity, and maybe even not just human. I was listening to the birds last summer, and they were doing call and response from one tree to the next.
Yeah.
I mean, they were singing to each other. Is this like a natural thing that our brain is wired to do and to sense? Glasner tells us a story of one Alzheimer's patient named Norman who liked to sing the Frank Sinatra song, Fly Me to the Moon.
So we do a medley of The End of the Owl and the Pussycat, which is Hand in Hand on the Edge of the Sand, We Dance by the Light of the Moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. And then Norman knows that's his cue to sing Fly Me to the Moon. So that shows that he's internalized that that's his cue without being instructed. But then he's gone another step. He's created a joke. So where the line says, Darling, kiss me, he's changed it to, Don't you kiss me. So you got this group of 30, 40 participants in the adult day program, and about half of them are remembering that that's the joke. So they'll all wag their fingers and say it, and then they created a second joke, which is, why not? So they'll say, don't you kiss me, and then they'll shrug their shoulders and say, why not? So you're seeing them over a period of time remember cues from session to session and to create new jokes. And so that's very intriguing to think of. The story of Alzheimer's and dementia might include creating new memories.
Glasner says that song and poetry are not only valuable for the person suffering from Alzheimer's, but also for the family members and the caregivers who may have lost hope of ever really seeing again the person that they remembered and loved.
When Norman's son and his daughter-in-law came and saw for the first time Norman leading the group, and singing Fly Me to the Moon, they just, you know, they were overwhelmed and they were crying with joy. And they knew that he sang those songs. He did that at home all the time. But they'd never seen him with 30 people belting out Fly Me to the Moon. So what we find is they view the people as more human when they watch them engaged in creativity. And so that translates, if you're a medical student or you're a doctor and you're seeing the person more fully human, you're probably going to provide a different level of care, right? So that's the idea. And we're doing this same study with 20 nursing homes in Wisconsin. And so they'll say, you know, things like, I never knew it could be so fun hanging out with people with memory loss, you know, this kind of stuff. So you really see the caregiver shift.
One of the questions I had for Glasner was whether brains can actually improve when they practice these kinds of activities. In other words, if they're forming new memories, are they actually improving their synaptic connections?
Well, that's one of the really cool things. There's a lot of work being done around the auditory cortex and stimulating the auditory cortex. It seems that using call and response stimulates the auditory cortex. I found a group of scientists that were doing work around this, and they were using tones to stimulate the auditory cortex. So not like we're using poetry to stimulate it, but they were using just tones. But what they were finding is that using tones to stimulate it released a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And this is an interesting idea because acetylcholine is one of the neurotransmitters that's deficient if a person has dementia. So the possibility that you may be helping to replace it by stimulating the auditory cortex through the performance of poetry using call and response is a really powerful theory. And so this paper that just got published kind of fleshes that out. And so the idea is, can we then go beyond that and do some PET scans, that kind of thing, and start to do research to see if the theory holds up? But they are finding what they call brain plasticity. So it's the ability of the brain to sort of repair itself and to change and to still grow. And that's what they're finding through doing these tones, stimulating tones. So it's possible that it can help to keep the brain plastic. It's not going to change the course of dementia, but it may You know, if you look at pharmaceuticals and what they're able to do, it's very, very limited. So if you could use something that's not a pharmaceutical, that's an organic process to help stimulate people's brains in the face of this just devastating disease, that would be quite remarkable. But it is pretty exciting to think that poetry might be able to do something like that.
When you're working with Alzheimer's patients, with dementia patients, what are the poems and songs that you found to be really effective in reaching them? I mean, you talked about that poem, I shot an arrow in the air, it fell to earth, I knew not where. What are some others?
Well, so, you know, one thing is, you know, you're talking about people that are maybe 80, 90, even 100 years old. Yeah, maybe they studied romantic poetry. You know, maybe they know Daffodils by William Wordsworth. They know Shakespeare for sure. But what happens when the age shifts and you get more into the baby boomer generation, which is happening already? So some of the really great touchstones that we're finding, and we did this at a session in Washington, D.C. So we had a band come in as the guest artist, and the song that reached the people the most was My Girl. So what we do with My Girl is everybody's singing along, but when we get to the My Girl part, we stop, and then whatever the people's names are, My Shirley, you know, My Bill, so everybody gets to be the object of the song, and it's participatory and inclusive then, instead of just listening. We also use James Brown a lot, especially I Feel Good is a great text to use. I think the key is, are you excited by it? And if you're excited by the poem or the song, then the group is going to pick up on that excitement.
I keep finding myself, when I'm thinking about your work, contemplating the deep importance of cultural education in the first place. I mean, the importance of having the arts be integral to our education and not just an add-on, you know, which is sometimes the way it's thought about in schools today. But it's profoundly meaningful at every stage of life, not just old age. But your work really kind of brings that forward.
Yeah, I think that's really such a great way to think about this. And we do a lot of work with kids. They call it intergenerational work. So in Brooklyn, my main base on the ground floor is New York Memory Center, an adult day program. And on the second floor is 14th Street Preschool. And the little kids, the littlest ones are 2.5 and 3.
Do the preschool kids interact with the old folks?
Yeah, so we teach them, we use call and response, same exact thing, and they'll recite the poems, you know. So, I mean, it's really, really sweet. And one of the women at New York Memory Center, Ola, has a contest when the kids come in. She tries to see how many she can get to sit on her lap. And she's up to 8. She's gotten 8 kids on her lap. We say we're going to go visit the neighbors. So we're going to go downstairs and visit the neighbors. And they just love each other. They love each other so much that now this group of people with dementia, you know, mid to late stage dementia, when I walk in the room without the kids, they say, Gary, go get the kids. So
does this kind of work tend to stimulate social interactions among the patients after you leave? I mean, is there kind of a ripple effect once the session is over?
Yeah, what we hear back is that often the people will still be talking about it later. And sometimes the dementia is such that, you know, at the end of the session, they really cannot articulate that they've just done that with you. But their mood will be elevated and they will be more social.
I think this work raises really profound questions about the value of people who are no longer in the mainstream. They're no longer in the marketplace. They're no longer movers and shakers. They're somebody's old mom or dad. And yet the value of their life is still very real. And I think it's important to think about that value.
Yeah, I have so many times, you know, where if you were observing the session, you might not even think that the person's being affected. But I remember one time in Las Cruces, I was doing Red Rose by Robert Burns. So my love is like a red, red rose. It's newly sprung in June. And this woman really, I thought she was asleep, but I was doing the poem and I just kind of brushed her hand as I was going around the room. and she grabbed onto me with her pinky. Her pinky latched onto me, and she wouldn't let go until the poem was finished. And, you know, from across the room, you might not even notice, but there's a core that's there, that humanity's there, and I think it says a lot for us as a society and as a community that we honor those people and we do try to make their lives as meaningful as possible.
So we end with a question that every person who's working with an Alzheimer's patient needs to figure out for him or herself. And that is how to honor the humanity of a person who's still alive but seems to be long gone and whose dignity and sense of self has been stripped away in so many ways. My stepfather George became more confused and distant over time, and after he'd been in the care facility for some years, he seemed to be completely incapacitated and unaware. Because he was so robust, he lived quite a long time. But my mother visited him less over the years. She'd made a conscious choice to go on with her own life and to move out west to be near me. One day, she received a call from George's nurses that his health was failing and he had only days to live. She got on a plane and was there the following day. When she entered the room, George looked straight at her and he smiled. The next morning, he died. You've been listening to Thought Huddle. We're coming to you from Arizona State University. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. You can find us on iTunes, on your podcast app, and at thoughthuddle.com. Thanks to Nikai Salcido and Zaylee Pollan for production assistance on this podcast, and to Ross Hamlin for the music. And thanks to you for listening. On our next program, we'll be talking about dogs. So stay tuned, and we'll see you next time.